Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, and welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Network. The following show is just horrifying. Beware.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you wanna make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. I'm your host for today, Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman. I'm bringing back Monroeville Mall. You know why? Because I realized at least, I don't know, maybe a week ago, which is about 8 or 9 months into this year, that A, I haven't seen Rose Red, and B, I wasn't on the Rose Red episode. So C, why the hell am I using Rose Red as my nickname for this year? So we're going back to Pittsburgh with at least my nickname, and we're going to go with Monroeville Mall Rothman, which is what I'm going to be keeping here in my mind going forward. But guess what? We're not going to Monroeville Mall. We're going to Castle Rock, specifically Castle Rock Kitchen. Yes, the new book by author Teresa Carl Sanders. And we're going to be talking to her today. And I'm not going to be alone in that conversation. I have one of my favorite co-hosts. I want to play favorites today. Possibly my favorite co-host. Yes. Jen, please introduce yourself.
Hey, this is Jen, the best co-host.
Yes, seriously.
I'm sorry. We kid. We love everyone equally.
We do. We do. I can't, you know, some of my best friends are on this podcast, but look, you are my best friend too. So that's not an equal, you know, there's no modifiers here. So, right. Jen, are you good in the kitchen? Cause I'm not, I know two or three things in the kitchen and that's it.
I'm okay in the kitchen. I don't cook that much. Cause, Corey and I got in a big fight a long time ago about cooking, so I just haven't cooked dinner in like years.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I like to cook, then I can do some pretty cool stuff, you know? I've recently discovered Pampered Chef. So
what is Pampered Chef?
All my money.
What's that?
It's a line of like really expensive kitchenware stuff,
okay.
But it's really fancy and cool. I have a specific like thing that's for knife tasting or knife testing. And
knife tasting. That would be a
knife
bad
tasting.
Idea.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, well, let me see if I can fit this in my mouth. Yeah.
So I'm not a spokesperson for Pampered Chef. Let's just say.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll be a kind of a spokesperson for this next plug. I was a huge fan of Blue Apron during the pandemic. Like I was cooking every night during the pandemic because A, there's nothing to do. I don't know why I keep doing this A, B, C thing. Well, we're just going to go with it. So A, there was nothing to do. And B, you know, I didn't really want to go to the grocery store. So we just kept ordering Blue Apron and I had a blast with it. And I was really feeling like I was, I don't know, the show wasn't out yet, but I guess in hindsight, I probably felt like I was the character in The Bear, you know, just like, just, you know, preparing all these great dishes. And I saved all the recipes because they come in these like cool little cardboard things. And so I was like, all right, I'll make them one day. And so a few months back when I was like, all right, let's see if I could retain any knowledge from cooking. And I pulled out one of the menus, one of the recipes. And I absolutely botched it. Just like, just destroyed it. Yeah. And I was like, okay, so I'm not going to be Emeril anytime soon or anything. But
yeah.
The good news is that I did try it again because I'm the type of guy that's, I'm like Rocky. I keep running up those stairs. So I did try it again. I managed to ace a meatloaf, which makes me think.
Oh, nice.
That I could possibly manage to successfully cook any one of the recipes that we have here in Castle Rock Kitchen. Look, I brought it all back. How about that?
Yeah, nice.
Jen, you had a chance to look through this. Obviously, we both did because we interviewed Teresa. But were there any recipes that, you know, caught your eye that you really want to try to make?
Oh, the cheesecake.
Yeah,
yes.
Me too.
Corey is a really good cheesecake chef. So I want to give him that recipe and have him make it for me. So yeah.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of really good stuff. The lobster pickens too. It's like,
Yeah, there's like fig bars or some bars that have to do with the long walk that I really love. And I really want to try to make those. And there was another one that was like a dinner dish that looks absolutely, the blue plate special from 1122-63. I really want to make that. And also I'm a big breakfast guy, so I really want to make pancakes with toasters.
There's a French toast casserole, yes. I think, that looks really yummy.
The Dog Days French Toast, which is from Cujo. So you're all probably sitting here and thinking, what the fuck are they talking about? And these are all recipes, again, in Castle Rock Kitchen. It's out October 4th. And we're going to talk to the author right now. It's a great conversation, 45 minutes. Really get into the nitty gritty on how she made this incredible book and also how she managed to work with Stephen King, who wrote a foreword for this
book.
Which
is so cool.
It's very cool. And it's such a Kingian sort of intro with just filled with jokes and filled with local flavor, no pun intended. So should we get to this interview? I feel like let's just do it.
Hello.
Hello. First off, thank you so much for doing this. I was so excited for this book the second it was announced because, what can I say? I'm a sucker for the themed cookbook. I'm a sucker for themed, like eateries themed everything in a way. But you really gotta kind of have to toe a line to make it really work without it becoming tacky. And I just love this. This is just the perfect organic way to go about it. First off, I am Michael Rothman of the Losers Club. This is my co-host Jen Adams.
Hello.
Hi, Mike and Jen. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for talking to us. And I wanted to start at the beginning because we ask every one of our guests the same question, but I think it's a good question to ask, especially on the topic of King, which is, what is your Stephen King origin story? What was the first book or first time that you came across his work?
The first time I came across his work was actually the movie adaptation of The Shining.
His favorite movie.
I hate telling this story because I know how much he doesn't like it. And I don't think I made it much past the elevator scene. I was only about 8. And anyway, and then about 6 months later, my best friend in the whole world, we're still best friends. We've been friends since we were 5 years old. That's almost 50 years. We were up at Whistler. So I don't know. That's a ski resort near Vancouver.
Yeah.
And my family had a cabin up there in the 70s. And we were 8 or 9, and we were babysitting the 6-year-old boy that was with my parents' friends. And we were supposed to be really good. But instead, Jessica started scaring me and she started running around. I wish you guys could see me, but with her index finger, red rum, red rum, red rum.
Oh my God.
And if the kid, if it had been now, the kid would have had a phone and he would have had video evidence of the whole thing. But it went on for a long time. And eventually I was bigger than her and she was wearing my house coat. And so to put a stop to it, I wrestled her out of my house coat and pushed her outside onto the deck.
Oh, wow.
Where she promptly would have frozen to death very quickly had she not promised never to do it again.
Yeah.
A la The Shining.
Yeah, seriously. Smash cut to the face.
But I really started reading King, I think, after I married my husband, who's a huge King fan, huge horror fan in general. And it was with the basics, the stuff at the very beginning. Again, The Shining, I made it through that time. And The Stand. And The Stand is, I think, probably, it's one of my very favorites.
Same.
Yeah, I was going to say it. Same as Jen.
Oh. Me too.
Yeah. Yeah. I could read it. It could be a book that, like a desert island book for me, because I just think you can read it over and over and over again.
And I have.
I now have too. And taken very laborious notes about the food in it. And there's a lot of food in there, which is another reason why it's my favorite. One of my favorites. And then the other one I really, really like is 1122-63.
Love that one.
And I'm a time travel. I'll try anything, read anything, watch anything that's time travel. So,
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned 1122 because so we have a section on the podcast called Pound Cake. And we call it Pound Cake because it's more like the smuttier instances in his works. And it's because, you know, the innuendo for the book is when they call it Pound Cake. But we've always talked, I mean, we've, you know, for the past 5 years doing this podcast, anytime we come across, like, if we go to a store and it just says pound cake on a package or something like that, we always take a photo and just share it. So when it comes to food for King, that is one of the first things we go to mentally, is just like, oh yeah, pound cake. That makes sense.
I wish I'd known that. I would have made a pound cake just for you.
You know, it's funny. It was the first thing I thought of when I was going into this. But then I was like, oh, that's kind of a gross thing to when you think about it. Just thinking of Jake and Sadie having sex. But no spoilers, I guess, for you haven't gotten to that book. But so, you know, in terms of the food, though, what food did you grow up with? And how did you get into, you know, the world of cookbooks for this?
That's a good question. I grew up in Vancouver, BC. I was born and raised there. And Vancouver, even in the 70s, had a really good food scene. And my dad loved food. My dad had been sent to Europe for work many times. And so he developed an affinity for good food and good wine. And we used to eat out all the time.
Same.
At a time when, not like now, like nobody really ate out then, but I grew up in restaurants. So I was really lucky. I learned how to behave in restaurants too, just with my dad. That one look across the table, boy, that could stop everybody.
It's important. It's very important. Yeah.
And then at the same time as I was growing up, my friend again, Jessica, her mother loved to throw parties, and I was allowed to come and help all the time. And the other thing she had was a lot of food magazines. So she had and Martha Stewart cookbooks from in the early 80s and things like that. And I grew up reading cookbooks and recipe and food magazines. So when I write recipes, it's pretty, I think it just comes from a deep part in my brain. I also have, I'm a trained cook. So I sort of had this weird, my dad wanted me to be a cook and it never happened. And I traveled and I met a guy in England. And when we got back here, I was 25 and everybody told me, okay, time to stop goofing around, time to get a real job. So I got a real job and I hated it. I hated every minute of it. And finally, my husband used to beg me to quit. And I quit. And then we moved to a small island and we've lived there for the last 18 years. We just moved recently. We moved to a small island in between Vancouver and Victoria. And after my dad died, I had an opportunity to reset and go back to cooking school. So that's what I did. I went back and moved in with my mom and helped her adjust for the first 6 months and went to cooking school at night. And then I went back to the small little island and worked at little restaurants and made bread and breakfast buns for the farmers market for many years. And then one day I was walking in the woods and I thought of this idea for a recipe from a book called Outlander.
Yeah.
And that's, I've written two cookbooks based on Outlander by Diana Gabaldon. And that's when it started. That started in 2009.
It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, that hell of a journey too. And honestly, there's a lot of connective tissue with us because one of our first co-hosts, Allison Shoemaker, she actually left this podcast to start an at the time, maybe she had the podcast already, but it's called Podlander. And so she has an Outlander podcast. So there's this, we do have a marriage here of the story, of the two IPs.
There's a lot of common fans, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think at the time she was like, all right, I could see the fans here. I'm going. And we were like, the door is always open. So yeah. Sorry, Jen.
Well, and I imagine, you're fine. I imagine there's kind of similarities between the two kind of styles of cuisine also, because they're both kind of island areas. But did you find it kind of harder to get into the headspace of a cuisine from a place that you're not from? If that makes sense.
And you mean main cuisine?
Main cuisine, yeah.
Yeah, Stephen King said yes to the project on January 21st, 2021.
Wow.
Wow, that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah.
Sorry, 2020.
Okay.
Okay. Well, great year, honestly, for it.
Oh, yeah.
So much time in the to be able to work on it, for sure, I would imagine.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. And so I was reading and reading and reading all through the pandemic.
Like, one of the things I love about King's writing is that he does bring a lot of food into it. And you mentioned The Shining. One of my favorite scenes is when they're walking through the pantry and, you know, they're just listing the food. And I just find it so soothing. And so there's just a comfort to that scene. And I think, like, food is such a unique way to share culture, and I find that King is really good at that. So what was the origin of wanting to do a Stephen King cookbook?
Well, I had finished Outlander Kitchen, the second one, and I was looking for a new project and to write a fictional cookbook. I really wanted to do another one, but there's a few things you need. You need a prodigious author, which is a check for Mr. King. You need a big you need a big fandom, and you need them to include food in their books. And I'll be honest, I read them in the order that they were published.
Oh wow!
So Carrie has a hamburger and a root. And at that point, I was like, oh, geez, that's a good idea. And then I moved on. And then by Salem's Lot, there's a pretty nice sounding bolognese sauce in there, like a spaghetti sauce. And by the time, and then the last book that had been published when I started reading was Elevation.
Yeah.
And Elevation has a gourmet Mexican restaurant in it, in Castle Rock. So there is so much food, and it really evolves. Like it, at the beginning, in the early books, it's all really Maine comfort food. Anything that's in Maine, there's chop suey everywhere. And this is a funny thing, because when I wrote to him to ask him the idea and I came up with a proposal, I had chop suey, and I had never heard of anything but Chinese chop suey. So my chop suey was barbecue pork chop suey.
Yeah.
Well, which made me look pretty dumb. If you're from New England and you know that chop suey is basically macaroni, canned tomatoes, ground beef, and a few other things, depending on where you are, it's really tasty, but it's nothing like the chop suey that this Vancouver kid on the Asian Pacific Rim thought it was.
Yeah, as I was reading through it, there were a lot of like Maine-isms, and you can tell that there's this really deep cultural connection to the place, which is something you can feel in King's writing. Actually, I got a little misty when I was reading some of the introductions, because I can just feel the love for his stories coming through the recipes. How did you go through, like you mentioned, like reading through them chronologically, but how did you compile your list, and how did you go about pulling the quotes that you used to introduce the recipes?
I read on a Kindle. And so I highlight every mention of food, you know, that pantry scene in The Shining. That's a gem for me. If I need a filler recipe, then I can go to that pantry and pick out a couple of ingredients and make up something that's really not even there. Nice. Yeah. And also, a lot of authors do, or things just come up, things are described as food, or something pops into my head when I'm reading and I think, oh, we could make a recipe out of that. And then once I've read everything, I throw it, I type them all into a worksheet, an Excel spreadsheet. And I think at the time when I started the proposal, I had 600 lines of food mentioned. So I take everything, all the duplicate mentions, I write all those down, because once I start compiling a table of contents, then I'm looking for the best excerpt. It's the art of picking the excerpt. So, you know, like chop suey is mentioned probably 20 times in 40 books. So you have to pick the best chop suey. And what happens in books as well in life is when people are sitting around a table eating, or even just having a sandwich at lunch, they start talking about things and emotions come up and poignant scenes happen with food. And that's something I really learned in Outlander Kitchen, is how to pick the right excerpt, because, you know, it's mostly oatmeal and bread ale. So you have to pick the best porridge excerpt you can. And the same thing happened with Mr. King. He likes tuna fish sandwiches. He likes chop suey. There's a few things he repeats over and over and over. But then that evolution happens, and we get into the 21st century, and there's so much good food in all those books, but we had to narrow it down. So we narrowed it down to his stories that take place in Maine. So that means we left quite a few stories behind.
Interesting.
So we left The Stand behind. I mean, we could have started with The Stand, because it does start, but I chose to leave it behind. But The Shining, there's a great last scene in The Shining when the Torrances go to visit Dick Halloran at the very, very end, and he's in Maine. So we have Dick Halloran's baked beans, which are very close to my heart. because he's cooking baked beans when they get there. And that's a big main food. That's a huge main food.
That's the first one I was like, okay, I can do this. I'm like, all right. I did Blue Apron during the pandemic and I was like, I'm learning some things. And I thought after a year of doing it, I'd be like, all right, I'm going to be a fucking pro at this. And then like, I go and I saved all the recipes. And then I went to try like one and it flopped. And then I tried a meatloaf, which is the easiest one ever. And I was like, okay, this is good. So when I was looking at the recipes, the baked beans were the first ones I came upon. I was like, I could get this. And you know what? I love baked beans. So this is what I'm going to try. So that's going to be the first one I go to. The process is really smart. And I think it's so interesting too, because I just, while thinking about this and just pouring through the entire book, I started getting overwhelmed because I was like, oh my God, like there is so much research that must have gone into this, not only for just the stories, but then you also go the extra mile and like, you know, for example, you have like the pantry notes and you really add some authenticity by stressing like, no, like I also did my research about what they're doing in New England. And as you mentioned with the chop suey, yes. What was the process for that like when you had to go, you know, beyond the books? Like, did you have to like, I don't know, like call up shopkeepers and or talk to historians or chefs, or how did that go?
I made a few calls looking for Alan's coffee brandy, which he mentions quite a bit in his earlier books. And it is I don't know if it's still true, but when I was writing the book, it is the most popular liquor in Maine. So it's more popular than vodka, and only beer and wine sales outstrip Alan's Coffee Brand.
But that
can't get it in Canada. I don't know if you can get it outside the state. You probably can in a few neighboring states. So that was a tricky one, but mostly it's cookbooks. There's some really nice cookbooks. The Lost Kitchen is one that's a Maine centric cookbook, and there's lots of old Maine is really great for archiving all their old stuff, all their old recipes and like agriculture, all this stuff online. And it was the pandemic. So I was stuck at home most of the time on a small island, like for many months, we couldn't even leave the island.
Oh, wow.
It was late. Yeah. It was a bit of a penal colony.
and sounds like Dolores Claiborne.
We always had toilet paper though. Our grocery store manager was like, he was the toilet paper king.
Amazing.
Nobody walked out of there with more than one package of toilet paper at a time.
Did you find any books where you couldn't find anything to write about any mention of food?
Yes, I did. I'm just trying to think of one, but The Dark Half, I think, is one.
Interesting.
I mean, there is, but most of the time there's a lot of soup being heated up, I think, in the if I recall. And there were a few others. I mean, I read a lot of short stories too, as many short stories as I could find that take place in Maine. I know I missed some because I found them after. Online and cookbooks, and I talked to Mr. King. I talked to Stephen King. I had a half an hour with him on the phone, and he told me a bunch about what his grandmother and his mom used to make. We talked about my narrator. I think he thought Mrs. Garrity from The Long Walk was a bit of an odd choice for a narrator.
I was going to ask about that. That's an interesting.
And we can talk about it. We can talk about it later, but it worked for me, and it. I think she adds a depth to the book. I didn't want to pick somebody that already had a voice. Mr. King had already given a voice to. And I had a couple of suggestions from people, and like Dick Halloran, which I think is not appropriate. So. and I don't think I could really pull off a Southern black man's voice, to be honest. Whereas Mrs. Garrity kind of popped up in The Long Walk. It's the first book he ever read or ever wrote. And she only, I think she has three words in total. but she's lived in Maine all her life. She's certainly not getting out of there, is she? So she's stuck there, and she's mm-hmm. got all the history and all the cookbooks of her foremothers to draw upon. And so that's, and I got to sort of mimic Stephen King without copying Stephen King, my ultimate nightmare.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that she doesn't really have a voice. So you're adding, you're essentially giving her one. And I'm curious, how did you get King involved with this? And did he give you any insight into Mrs. Garrity? And what was his response to you kind of giving her a voice?
I have an agent who can talk anybody into anything, give her two floors on an elevator.
Oh, nice. And she's can you send her my number?
And I think she probably pulled in a favor to get his agent's name and number. And they talked, and he was very he's passed away now, but he was very, very generous, and took it to Stephen King, and Stephen King said yes. And I mean, she was in traffic in LA when she called me, and I was on my tiny little island on Pender, and I went out to the balcony and screamed hurrah. And that was about that was about 2 weeks before the pandemic hit, and then we went nowhere for 6 months.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. He I think he thought she was a strange choice just because she has no voice. Like, why would I pick her when mm-hmm. I could pick Dolores Claiborne, right? And he said to me, Dolores Claiborne is the most main character I've ever written. And I said, okay. So I dutifully went and read Dolores Claiborne again, and then I read it again. And he didn't really have much to say about it. I mean, we don't even know her first name, right? That's mm-hmm. how insignificant she is. So I've given her a bit of life.
You know, when you were speaking to him, did he talk about some of his own favorite foods and like maybe even some of his own recipes or maybe some of his go-tos? I know he always has that tongue-in-cheek anecdote about how he has the gloop, I think, the spaghetti gloop that he used to make. And which I think I actually did make a few years ago when I was like, that's not too bad because I love gloop of type spaghetti. But
there's like cheery casserole too with like cereal and like peanut butter that he fries or something.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Oh, wow. No, he did not go into that at all.
That might be in an introduction, not in an actual novel.
He likes to, older Stephen King, maybe. Now he likes to knead bread, he said. So he bakes his own bread.
Wow.
Tabitha cannot smell anything. So her taste is really affected. So she doesn't cook anymore. So he is the cook. So I don't know if you saw that Twitter thing where he stuck a piece of salmon in a microwave for 30 seconds or whatever, and then did something else awful to it. He didn't even season it, I don't think.
Yeah.
That's what I was like, salt. Just put salt on it. I can even deal with it if you just put salt on it. And he has a salmon recipe. He has cheesecake as his brain food. So
interesting.
The cheesecake on the back of the book is from The Body, and it's a blueberry cheesecake pie. So it's all sorts of really good things.
Oh, I'm making that for Thanksgiving this year.
Hopefully no ipecac in it though.
Yeah. And that uses wild Maine blueberries, which are quite different than cultivated blueberries. And that's something I learned actually during the pandemic. I was going down our little grocery store on our little island, and I looked over and there were Maine wild blueberries in the freezer. And I was like, wow, that's weird. Cool. I can use those. And I really like them. They're sweeter, quite a bit sweeter than regular. Yeah.
And so have you made every one of these recipes?
I wrote, created, and tested every one of these recipes. And then after that, I've got a group of 12 people that test all the recipes for me to make sure they work.
Oh, wow.
Do you have a personal favorite in the book?
That blueberry cheesecake pie is pretty good. Mm-hmm. And actually, funnily enough, also from The Body is Interstellar Escargot.
Yeah.
Which I had a choice in that paragraph. It was Tibetan something or Interstellar Escargot. And it's just two little boys being creative about and I decided to go with the escargot. And so I ordered on Amazon, got myself several cans of very nice French snails. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty, like, Interstellar is a pretty good name. Like, it's pretty alien when you open up a can of snails. I know what snails look like, so I was expecting it, but it's a bit tough. But it's actually a really, I like it because it's smart. It's a smart, fast recipe that anyone could make. It's salt and pepper squid, but I substituted snails for the squid.
Huh. I've never had escargot, but I might try it with this recipe.
Did you watch Stand By Me?
The testers all really liked it. I was quite surprised.
Really?
They've gotten brave. They've tested 18th century Scottish food for me too, though. So they're pretty brave. But
I was gonna say, that's a high hurdle.
Well, and you mentioned escargot. We're taught that's a brave food, I believe. And then you mentioned Stephen King's microwave fish recipe, which I think you'd also have to be pretty brave. And there is a mention of food that I've always been fascinated by, and it's in The Long Walk. And it is when he talks about, I think it's McVries who brings raw hamburger.
Yes.
And there are a couple of other times in King's writing where he talks about raw hamburger. Like, I think in The Body, they mold it around sticks and, like, roast it over a fire. So I was just curious, did you consider putting any kind of raw hamburger dish in the cookbook? Or, and is that something anyone should
even eat? Really, you can tell he's from a different time. Because I can remember my brother, all before foodborne illness, before any of that became a thing, I can remember my mother swatting my brother's hand away from the cutting board as she was forming hamburger patties because he was eating raw hamburger and he loved it.
My husband, it's supposed to be dangerous, right?
But that was a different time when the food system was quite a bit different and there weren't so many of us. So I made, gosh, we're talking about The Body a lot. I made that raw scorched hamburger, but I turned them into Sikh kebabs. So Indian spiced kebab, beef kebab.
Are fully nice.
Now, if you want to make them rare, make sure that you get a grass-fed animal from a farm that you know. And then you could probably still be safe if you ate it raw.
Were there sections? I mean, going into this, did you have, some favorite stories or novels that you just couldn't mine stuff from that maybe even disappointed? You're like, God, I wish we could have been able to include this.
Yes. I really wanted thinner. I really wanted to include thinner because that was what started it all. And I've got, 35 pictures of a slice of strawberry pie. And we couldn't do that because it doesn't take place. It's in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but there's other pies and other things. So that one we may never see. There's lots of books that aren't included, like The Dark Tower, all the fantasy books, those things. There's so much good food in those and there's so much room for creativity. But I like the focus of the main. I really liked it. When I pitched the idea, I didn't have that focus. The editor brought that focus and it's good because otherwise the book wouldn't be as creepy as it is. It wouldn't be as atmospheric. We wouldn't have maybe Jenny Bravo who took all the photos and Chantel Lambeth who styled all the food. The photos are creepy. They're dark, they're moody, and all the atmospheric ones from around Maine, she's done an incredible job. And I'm sorry that we had to leave some books and some food behind, but I'm really happy with what we worked with.
No, I honestly, I think it's so smart. And so we've done a couple of film festivals and we really tried to stay to a theme. And I remember when we did, the first one we did was Greetings from Castle Rock. And so I really set rules, similar rules for myself to be like, all right, they really got to be in the Castle Rock area. I mean, we kind of stretched it a little bit just because we played Creepshow that year. And I don't think that there's a mention of Castle Rock because of the street sign that's on, towards the end of the Geordie Verrill. But even then I was like, we had the programmer at the theater is just like, you don't have to stick by these rules. And I was just like, no, we do. We have to stick by these rules. It's a theme. It's so important. So I applaud you for sticking to the theme and going with it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to ask about the imagery, because the cookbook, I love the look of it. And it looks like, it feels like Maine, but it also feels very like down home and really accessible and kind of rustic. And I was just wondering, were there specific reference points you used for the imagery and for like designing some of the pictures of the recipes?
A cookbook author has very little to do with
really.
And often very little to do with the cover. I've been lucky in my career. I've had a voice in all of them. They shot down in Maine, and they shot all food in 1 week. And the week after they had finished, the Canadian and US border opened up. So I couldn't go. I missed it by a week. But I saw the dailies every day. And the art director from 10 Speed Press was with them for the first couple of days. 10 Speed's been really great and treated this like a serious cookbook, which has been difficult to get people to take them seriously in my career. And then once those first dailies came back, we really just let them fly, because they were doing, they got it so well. I'm not a particularly visual person. I work with words, and they got what we were looking for so well that it's really Jenny's baby, all those photos. I had a voice in picking some, because we had so many, especially exterior shots. We had so many great ones to choose from. But it was a good group collective effort that put the whole thing together.
And it's so hard. Like food photography is so hard. My ex-wife was in marketing, or like food marketing. And she would say, I remember she'd come home like after an 8 hour shoot, and they'd be like, well, we got the burger. And I'm like, what? And it's like 8 hours. And, you know, and she just said, it was like, you have no freaking clue how much work goes into one photo that you usually see in professional settings. It's a lot.
That's why I think it's amazing. I think they shot 45 or 50 food heroes, they call them, in a week. Yes. So they were making a lot of food, and they were shooting a lot of food, and it all looks amazing.
Yeah, it really looks
and
good.
Some of it's quite hard. Like, you know, comfort food sometimes can be hard to make look good. But there's a picture of bolognese that looks like a Renaissance painting. And there's a couple of other pictures, like of mushrooms. There's a full spread of mushrooms and a full spread of a lobster. And they look just like Renaissance paintings. Amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The French toast casserole photo is the one that was like, I'm doing research for it. I was just like, God, just you order breakfast right now. You want to order breakfast? It's like 8 o'clock at night. It's just a beautiful book, but, I wanted to talk about the fictional characters for a second though, because like one of the things I really love about this that just really astounded me is kind of going back to what I was saying with the theme. And this is right in our wheelhouse, because even in our episodes, and I get a lot of guff from a lot of the co-hosts because I spend a little bit too much time setting the scene. Like we did an episode on The Shining, and I think I spent like 15 minutes doing the whole monologue from The Shining, and then also acting like we were in the office and, you know, trying to create the scene. So I really love the personalization here with the cookbook and having the characters, you know. When was that? Was that always the idea that you had, or did it come naturally? Was there, you know, for The Long Walk, was it just that you went chronologically to start in that place because of the King's timeline? What was the conceptual nature of that aspect of this all?
That was an idea from 10 Speed Press. I'd never done anything this immersive or this in-world before. And I was a little terrified, to be honest. And I was really terrified that at the end of it, Stephen King was going to look at it and say yay or nay about it. But it grew. It grew from a suggestion, and I think I took it I took it really far. And I'm really happy that I did. It's the most creative thing. You know, writing recipes is like, I tell people, is like writing a VCR repair or a VCR instruction manual, except every recipe is a different brand of VCR. So there's a Sony, there's a Toshiba, there's a blah, there's a set way that you do it. And to be able to stretch my legs and write like 500 word introductions at the beginning of every chapter in this person's voice that I've kind of made up was amazing. I'm not a world builder. I'm never going to write a novel. That's probably the most creative type of thing I'll ever do, is I work in other people's worlds. I'm really happy to pick and choose from other people's worlds. And I would, I totally want to do it again. It was, it had me jazzed the whole time I was doing it. I really enjoyed writing, and normally after the recipes are written, when you have to write the intros for chapters and stuff, it can be really dry and it can be really tough to say tasty and delicious without saying tasty and delicious.
Yeah.
So this, this was, it was a suggestion that we started with, and it just kept growing and growing, and partially because we were in that pandemic and it was so everybody was set in such an insular space, and I had this time to think creatively. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's perfect for King's writing, because when you read a Stephen King story, you feel like you're entering his world, and this just feels like a part of that. You know, it feels like a piece of Stephen King's dominion, as we call it on the podcast. And one of the things that I noticed, I'm a huge fan of the story Grandma. So whenever she pops up, I always take notice.
I thought of you, Jen, when I was getting this. I was like, she's just going to lose her mind over this.
Oh, yeah. I talk about Grandma and Mrs. Todd. I talk about all the time. But also Dolores Claiborne. She's one of my favorite characters that Stephen King has ever written. And I noticed that a lot of the characters that we've been talking about and that pop up in the book are his female characters. And, you know, I don't want to generalize, but I find that, you know, a lot of times women carry culture through cooking, which I think is a really kind of beautiful way to pass on traditions. And I was just curious, do you have any particular favorites of his female characters?
I really love Grandma too. And that was one of those, like, her, I mean, it's not a very delectable excerpt. I mean, she smells like poached eggs, and I've made poached eggs. But Dolores Claiborne, I really like Lisi's story. She's not, I don't think Lisi's somebody I would hang out with, but there's something about her, that story, that I really, really enjoyed. And Sadie, Sadie really, that book touches me.
That's, I mean, again, we haven't gotten to the book yet because we're doing like a chronological reread. Okay. So everyone, and we just got like a 3-star review, because they're like, no 1122 review. And I was like, well, we're getting like, there.
We haven't gotten
there. That is a novel that, like, the love story in that book, like, I feel like I needed to go to therapy after the book. Was like, I couldn't get over. I was like, I can't believe I'm not going to be living with them anymore. Like, I love this love story so much. That one especially gets me.
Did you find that there were any particular characters that you liked to write as, or that you kind of, as you were going through, that you wished you could have thrown in that you weren't able to?
I certainly adopted the voices of a few, and I tried not to make it too cheap. I allowed myself one eye up in there. I don't even know how to say it.
We don't either. We always mess it up, but
I'll have my ears wide open when I go down there listening for it. Yeah. There's an idea for maybe a second cookbook, and I think there, I have another voice in mind, and doing it a little bit differently, maybe, because Mrs. Garrity, boy, I've stretched her, I think, to the limit.
I wanted to ask too, because you've mentioned the stories that you weren't able to include because they don't take place in Maine. Exactly. Would this book that you're talking about maybe be a non-Maine Stephen King cookbook?
Yes. Yeah. We're just in the middle of figuring it out. We have an important yes that we have been given. So I have permission to work on it. And I'm headed towards a fantasy cookbook. The Dark Tower, and anything that has Randall Flagg in it connects to the Dark Towers. So The Stand would be in there. Eyes of the Dragon would be in there. Fairy Tale could be in there. Then there's lots of short stories that he links to the Dark Tower. So there's definitely enough material.
Yeah. You'd have a lobstrosity roll.
Yeah. I actually, at this point, it's a lobstrosity lumpia, which is a Filipino egg roll.
Just because
lobster roll is just
a very main thing.
And it's just a bit too easy, too. Like, it's not really a recipe. You know what I mean? Toss lobster in mayo.
Yeah.
Put on bun.
Monstrosity is just such a fun word.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. Like, yeah, no, I've been playing with that. I have almost an entire spreadsheet just devoted to lobstrosity.
So. Oh, really?
Wow. The number of things you could do with it.
The first thing I thought of when the cookbook, before I knew it was Maine centric, was the gunslinger burrito. I think that was the first thing that some of our listeners were saying. And I can imagine how much fun that could go with that.
Popkins.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think is my number one Twitter demand that I get thrown at me. And I'm like, oh, dear. I can feel some one-star reviews on Amazon coming now. I'm sorry, guys. It's only in Maine, but we're trying. We're working.
Right.
I think a lot of it is that, with that, how much research you've done, I have to imagine that this next one would probably be a little easier, right? Or is it going to be just as hard to put all together?
Well, I really enjoyed it, but the last 2 weeks of putting it all together, making sure that my voice is consistent and I'm talking about the right thing and what I'm saying is actually right. And I'm not, because, you know, when you're looking on the internet, sometimes things aren't always accurate. So getting at least three sources of everything when I'm talking about it, when I'm talking about a story in Mrs. Garrity's voice, just to make sure I'm accurate, because I've worked in fandoms before and I know how important it is to get things right. So, yeah.
Well, and then you have the added demand of making sure the recipes work as well. So you're really kind of playing in a lot of different accuracy worlds, you know, which I imagine is challenging.
I think that's why I had so much fun writing in this fictional voice this time, because it did add a layer of complexity and I wasn't just doing another Outlander kitchen book, but for Stephen King, it really is quite a bit different.
You can really feel King in the book. You know?
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's interesting too, because we just had Bev Vincent on last week, who also has a book out this month, and one of the revelations he had was that it's impossible to create a map of Castle Rock. But the silver lining here is that at least we have a cookbook that is coming from Castle Rock. So that's a win-win, I would say.
And the cookbook has a map.
Yes.
Not of Castle Rock, but a foodie kind of map of me. That's
And I love it. And I think honestly, all the listeners and the constant readers are going to absolutely eat this up, literally and metaphorically. But we are really excited that this is finally going to be out, and that we're also going to be going to Maine. And I think that, I don't know, I'm tossing this out there, Jen. I think that we should probably try to cook some of this stuff while we're in Maine.
I was going to say that. Yeah. We're going to have an Airbnb in Maine, and I think we should.
Wow. When are you doing that? When are you doing that?
Next week.
In a week.
Yeah. So we're leaving in a week from now. Yeah. So we'll have to let you know how some of these come up. And I know for a fact that we're certainly going to be sharing them on socials, and we're definitely going to, you know, be asking our listeners to tag us for recipes too. So.
Oh yeah.
Or for when they cook them, and we'll share them and stuff. So
sure. Yes.
But
Castle Rock Kitchen. I love people that tag their when they cook.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Teresa. This has been an absolute blast. Mm-hmm. And let's connect down the road sometime. And I'm really looking forward to another book. This one is an absolute delight. And constant listeners, get it now. Seriously. Mm-hmm. This is a must have for the collection.
Would you say get it while it's hot?
Get it while it's hot. Yeah.
That's just
puns galore. Jesus Christ. Well, have a great afternoon, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. It was a nice interview. I personally really want a Midworld cookbook, even though I'm not a huge Dark Tower fan. So
same. I feel like maybe that can be our way in. You know how, like, I don't think either one of us liked Lacey's story until we saw the show. Maybe it's that we don't like the Dark Tower until we eat like a dark tower cake or something, you know?
You know, it's, I'm glad you brought up Lisi's story because I didn't bring it up during the interview, but
eating nasty.
Exactly. And this is, this Lisi's story does take place in Castle Rock. It's at least, you know, outside of Castle Rock. I think Castle Lake it takes place on. Where was the Hamburger Helper? You could have done sort of hamburger, but maybe, you know, it is just specifically Hamburger Helper. So it's like, you know, Teresa's probably like, I don't really want to get involved in that one.
Yeah, if she is a listener of the pod, she might remember how we had to scrub a bunch of episodes. So maybe she doesn't want to have to like reprint the book and take Hamburger Helper trademark words out.
That is true. Yeah. Well, you know, look, I think we all know how to make Hamburger Helper.
Helpings or something.
Hamburger Helping. Yeah. The big helper, eating nasty and helping out. But I will say that is one Kingian dish I do know how to make. And I also forgot to mention this before, but the gloop that Stephen King famously made when he was living, I think before Carrie, actually, it was what he fed, I think, Joe and also himself. I've made it multiple times. It's one of my favorite things ever. The recipe's somewhere online. I think he did it as a joke, tongue in cheek. But so if you can't make any of the recipes here in Castle Rock Kitchen, you got the gloop and you got a Hamburger Helper. And that means that you're still somewhat in King's dominion. But I urge you to pick up this book and just try yourself. I mean, it doesn't hurt to try it. Like I mentioned before in the intro, I did all the Blue Apron stuff. I managed to nail it. There were a lot of times when I didn't nail it, though, like I mentioned before. But even with the Blue Apron box, when they gave you the ingredients and everything, my girlfriend Sammy can attest to it. I fucked it up so many times, but I still came back and I tried. And and that's what it takes with some of these recipes. And also beyond that, and Jen, you can attest this probably. I mean, like, there are a lot of really fun stories in this book.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I kind of just want to read it. Like, going through and reading Mrs. Garrity's voice. Like, I loved all the quotes to introduce. Like, that was really fun for me just to see what quotes she paired with what recipes, you know?
Which
was really cool. And there's a good range of, like, skill levels, too.
Oh, I totally.
Think, you know?
Like, I feel like desserts are sometimes hard, but I feel like they're at least some of the breakfast stuff I think is reasonable enough. I think French toast is not that hard. I think
it's not. It's essentially bread with eggs and you put it on a hot thing.
Yeah. So, and maybe watch Cujo. Maybe watch Louis Teague's Cujo while you're eating French toast.
eating nasty
with the French toast and with the dog, Cujo.
That should have been my nickname, Eating Nasty. Man.
Oh, God. I don't know if
it was
want
right
that.
There.
Yeah. We're like going into like serious episodes and you're just like, hey, I'm Jen Eating Nasty. Today we're going to be talking about, you know, it's like a serious book, like 11/22/63.
Right.
Well, what do we got next? Well, we've got a busy October up ahead. Holy hell. And you know what? This was a busy month for us because we got ahead of ourselves. We recorded many of the episodes that are coming up ahead next week. The first one to kick it off, ring, ring, ring. Answer the phone. It's Mr. Harrigan. Mr. Harrigan's call. Mr. Harrigan's phone is coming to Netflix. And we got a review going to you. And we also, and I'm recording this on Monday, and we're going to be hopefully speaking to him on Tuesday. So hopefully I'm not eating my words here. We are going to be talking to the star Jaden Martell. So of It also, cool. Chapter 1 and Chapter 2. So
yeah.
I'm hoping it's a good conversation. Watch it be an absolute disaster, but I'm jinxing it right
It'll
now.
It'll be fantastic.
Let's hope it is. But you can look forward to that. And also, by now, I believe our book episode for Fairy Tale should be in our Patreon. So
yeah,
that is
all 19 hours of it.
Yeah, seriously. Fucking Christ, is a long episode. We went on forever with that. And you can get it now at in the Barrens, patreon.com/thebarrens. But if you're thinking, I don't really want to spend $5, I didn't read Fairy Tale. That's not my chronological reread. That's fair. But guess what? You got some reading to do still, because we got Wolves of the Cala coming at the end of the month in the main feed, which then we're going to be following quickly with the Song of Susanna. And then also, because we are just sadists, we are going to be going right into The Dark Tower, the all 1,100, 1,200 pages of it for December. So
I mean,
a lot of reading ahead.
It's like 1,500 at least pages.
Yeah.
Like close to 2,000 pages we're going to be covering in the next like 3 months.
I cannot believe it that we decided to do this. I think we're a little crazy. The thing that I'm really elated knowing is that I'm not on any of them. So And neither are you.
I mean, same. Right. Exactly. Hey, we are your Dark Tower deniers, I guess.
Maybe. Yeah. I imagine you'll probably be on a lot of the long watches with us because.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was imagining. We'll be picking up the slack as they're making their way to the tower.
Yeah, because we're going to have we are going to be doing a long watch on The Mist in November for its 15th anniversary. So that'll be fun.
With Mr. Thomas Jane.
I'm trying. I'm throwing this right here. The pitch is out. I'm trying to get him back. That's one of my favorite interviews we've ever done. And I really want him back on the pod and we can go all in on The Mist because I think we only went really all in on 1922.
Oh, because that's right. I remember listening to that because it was right before 1922 came out.
Yeah, it was like a more career encompassing stuff. And then he went really in on the absinthe that was over, I guess, the whole cast on Dreamcatcher we're going into. It was fun. But we're hoping we get him back. We're hoping that you come back because we got so much content. So stick around. It's going to be a really fun, spooky season, a really fun October, and a really fun holiday season too. So shall we sign off?
Yeah, let's sign off.
I'll see you soon over long days
and
pleasant nights. I got some hot friends. 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 But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
This is the end of our show. For now. Tune in next week. If you like our programming, consider searching for other bloody disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.